All right, folks. We are going to get going. My name is Jim Bruggers, and I cover the environment for the Courier-Journal in Louisville, Kentucky. And this channel deals with water quality, water pollution, combined sewer overflows, these mega consent decrees that are happening all over in cities, and how we can cover them better. An Environmental Protection Agency enforcement person was supposed to be here, but got caught up in that government closure. So we have Paul Davis with us. He's a retired water pollution control director for Tennessee. So he kind of ran the water program here. And he happened to stumble in, and gratefully he's decided to help us out.
He signed up.
Yeah, with starting off, which is kind of a brief overview of the situation. And then we have John Devine, who's a senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council's water program. You can find his full bio online. And we also have Gordon Garner, who I've known for a long time. He ran the Louisville Metropolitan Sewer District when I first came to town in 1999. He works for CH2M Hill now. And he also is involved with the Kentucky Waterways Alliance, which is a statewide water advocacy group that helps keep the government in line.
On plaintiff.
Anyway,
in that.
So... my experience with this is the Louisville Metropolitan Sewer District, after he left, was hit with a consent decree of close to $1 billion, about $850 million. It's putting the agency under tremendous financial stress. People are watching their sewer rates go up. At the same time, you know, they're tackling this problem where billions of gallons of raw sewage was getting into the Ohio River and streams every year. So I've been covering it, living it for the last 10 years. Anyway, Paul, can you get going?
Sure. Does everybody know what combined sewers are? The difference between, I mean, they're sanitary sewer systems. Tanks and tubs and industrial discharges that go into lines that are dedicated flow to pump stations that lift wastewater to treatment facilities for treatment. And it's possible that those lines, when it rains, overflow, and if they do, that's called a sanitary sewer overflow. But from a technical standpoint, it's possible to eliminate that, or significantly, or almost eliminate it, get it to where those overflows are infrequent. Combined sewers are different. Combined sewers were built in the days where the practice of sanitary engineering was to get waste away from populations. And so what happened then was the curb cuts that you see, and the drains, the storm drains go to the same pipes in the ground that the toilets and tubs and sinks go to. and in dry weather and in relatively small rainfalls, that can be a good thing, because the people that flip their trash out in the city, if there's a very light rain, that's going to be removed, where in another city that didn't have combined sewers, that the storm sewer would carry it to urban waters. But in a moderate or heavy rain, what happens is the pipes and or treatment system just won't carry it all. And so you regularly have overflows into urban waters from combined sewers. And the Clean Water Act and the water enforcement regulatory program in this country recognize a difference between separate sanitary sewers and combined sewers. There are special rules that apply to combined sewers. There are There are, what is it, 9 special minimum control measures that have been identified as a matter of federal rule look at that. How about that? How do you know? What do you know? There are special things that you do. And if you do those things, if you do those things, you are not in, the operator is not in, is not in jail. And it's the objective of enforcement programs to see that those things are done. And from your standpoint, from the standpoint of educating public, the things that the regulatory program needs for you to do, and that the cause of public health needs for you to do is to tell populations and policymakers and leaders and groups why these are important, because believe me, they are expensive. They're real expensive. In Nashville, the number is over a billion dollars that have been spent, and they haven't eliminated combined sewer overflows yet.
They're just taking another bite of the apple.
They've done a good job, but it hadn't happened yet. So that's the.
Okay, so Paul, one of the things that comes up, I think, just clarify my understanding of this: sanitary sewer overflows are illegal and they have to be stopped. But what percentage of the what kind of a percent reduction is required for these combined sewer overflows? I mean, do you have to get down to 90% control?
I'm going to correct your question.
Okay.
Sanitary combined sewer overflows are illegal unless they are permitted and meet the conditions of the national CSO policy.
Okay.
And then they can be permitted.
So when you typically do controls, you have to get how much do you have to control?
How much
in Tennessee? What's the EPA requiring?
Well, Gordon will probably get to this, but there's to some extent it's a level of effort test.
A level of effort.
And so what we did I can talk about how Nashville and Chattanooga and Clarksville, we have 3 CSOs, but what we said was, you've got to show us how you're meeting the 9 minimum controls. We want you to bring in citizen groups. We ask for the press to be part of it. We want this to be very transparent. How is it that you're satisfying the requirement of a minimum level of effort? And it winds up with like the CSOs moving from the urban streams, where wadeable streams, where kids are getting in and floating boats during the rainfall, yeah, moving them out to the Cumberland River, where you just don't have that recreation presence. And so, yeah, protection of public health, all environment agencies are health first and fish and aquatic life very close second.
Okay,
that's what we.
It's changed in the 20 years since the policy was developed, but having been there at the beginning, the intent of the CSO policy was to provide the equivalent of secondary treatment for the combined sewer overflow situation. So the policy was aimed at eliminating 85 to 90% of either the flow or the mass loadings, yeah, from the CSOs. Now, that has changed considerably with the evolution of the policy, but that was the original intent. So instead of doing virtually nothing, which was the case 20 or 25 years ago, that 85 to 90% target was viewed as achievable as opposed to zero.
And ultimately, at the end of the day, the goal is meeting water quality standards. So,
yes.
So there, the receiving water has been given a designated use, whether that's swimming, fishing, sometimes drinking water supply, there are standards that are aimed at achieving that use. No more than X number of colony-forming units of a given bacteria, for instance. And so the long-term control plan that the CSO policy requires CSO communities to develop is supposed to aim at achieving those water quality standards. As Gordon said, the first in many circumstances, many communities are allowed to just do the 85% as a, and it's presumed to be in pursuit of that water quality goal. Some cities may not need to do that full 85%. They can demonstrate that through modeling and the like that reducing by something less than that amount will get to the water quality goals.
You're on.
All right. Rock and roll. Well, good morning. Thanks for having me. I'm John. I'm from the Natural Resources Defense Council. I'm based in Washington, D.C. I'm glad to talk about this issue. Wet weather issues generally are among the most pressing and complicated water pollution issues we have today, and so and one of the also biggest opportunities, in my view, to work with communities to improve them, not only from a water quality standpoint, but a overall urban livability standpoint. So to just picture a rainy day in the city, it's, you know, you're trying to hail a cab, water's running everywhere off rooftops and in the, you know, on the sides of the streets, pouring into the curb cuts that Paul mentioned. You see cigarette butts, that kind of rainbow sheen of oil and gas. You see grit and grime, and that's stormwater pollution. A lot of people don't think about stormwater as pollution, but that's what it is. And once it gets into the concrete systems that underlie our cities, a couple things can happen, as Paul was describing. In most places, it's collected and piped to nearby waterways without treatment. That's the stormwater side of the separate storm systems, sewer systems that Paul was describing. And that's why after a rainstorm near me, I see in the little creek near my house, styrofoam cups, and you'll see it all over the place because that's what's on the road, and that's what gets swept in without treatment. In about 772, I believe is the number, cities around the country, and you can see from the map in the bottom there kind of how they're dispersed. It's mostly in the Northeast and Great Lakes, with a few scattered elsewhere. We have these more antiquated combined sewer systems, which on dry days and small storms carry the flow to a wastewater treatment plant. But in larger storms, and as we've had increased development, it now doesn't take much of a storm in many places. Those systems can't deal with the load, and so you'll see they're designed to overflow. That's the bottom image on the left there. Essentially, it just there's a dam built into the.
It's called a leaping weir.
Is that what it is? I don't know if I like that. So in the communities where these are found, you'll often see signs by the river designating, you know, indicating where the discharge points are, and you don't need those signs on a rainy day. You can smell it. So that's what we're here to talk about today. What I wanted to focus on is what has increasingly become the solution to combined sewer overflows, which is a suite of techniques that we call green infrastructure. It's design strategies that mimic natural hydrology and capture rain where it falls. So in its simplest form, I think of green infrastructure as putting nature in the way of stormwater. And so I'd like to talk about these ideas this morning and what kind of policy approaches might help advance them. And I'd also like to talk a little bit about how I think journalists can help the public better understand what CSOs are, why they need to be addressed, and how green infrastructure fits in that program. The great thing about green infrastructure is that it keeps water from becoming wastewater. It turns it into an urban resource. And it also has a number of advantages for urban livability that conventional treatment or massive storage does not. And because of these multiple benefits, and because communities with CSOs are required by the Clean Water Act to develop and implement plans to ensure that their overflows won't jeopardize waterways uses for swimming and fishing and other things, communities have been increasingly turning to green infrastructure to keep stormwater out of their systems. NRDC did a report a couple years back where we profiled 20 communities, many of which had CSO systems, and their use of green infrastructure to address their pollution problems. We called it Rooftops to Rivers. And to assess the breadth of each of the cities that we looked at green infrastructure activities, we created a metric we called the Emerald City Scale. So we took six criteria that we worked with a number of communities to develop, as well as our colleagues at EPA. And essentially we said, we looked at whether communities had a long-term green infrastructure plan for the city, a requirement to retain a defined amount of runoff from development projects, whether it's new or redevelopment projects, a requirement to reduce the impact of existing impervious areas using green infrastructure, incentives for private party installation of green infrastructure, which is a big part of the needed investment, guidance or other assistance in deploying green infrastructure, and a dedicated funding source to help them go. And so I wanted to run through a couple of case studies, but I wanted to emphasize that they are just that there are communities across the country now that are embracing green infrastructure, whether it's small communities that we've worked with, like Edmonds in Maryland or Lancaster, Pennsylvania, or the biggest cities, New York and Los Angeles, have done a lot on green infrastructure. In our estimation, Philadelphia was the unquestioned champ with respect to green infrastructure. It's made an unparalleled commitment to use green infrastructure as the centerpiece of its Clean Water Act mandated CSO control plan, long-term control plan. The city will green a third of the acreage in its CSO service area, by which that means that they'll design it in a way that it'll retain the first inch of rainfall.
And that's both public and private.
That's right, yes. I think my guess is it'll largely be deployed on public land, at least in the first phase of work. But yes, they're looking at all impervious area in the CSO. Syracuse is investing about $80 million in green infrastructure over the next decade, and that will account for about two-thirds of the overflow reduction that they're expecting to achieve. On the West Coast, Portland has is one of the growing number of cities that has adopted a standard for new and redeveloped sites. So what that means is they have to be designed in a way from scratch that they retain a certain percentage of rainfall. Chicago has had a very strong green roof and green alleys program for quite some time. More than 150 alleys, as well as parking lots and bike lanes and plazas throughout the city have been greened. Nearly 500 green roofs as of a couple years ago, so probably more by now. We've had some also difficulty in Chicago. We've been fighting to ensure that the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District's long-term plan doesn't simply carry on what the city has been doing literally for many decades now. So we're hoping that they will improve the degree to which that or the speed at which they solve their CSO problem. As wonderful as green infrastructure is, it's not going to happen purely out of the goodness of folks' hearts. And so these, rather, will generally be driven by regulatory requirements and by municipal officials' desire to meet those requirements in a more cost-effective way. So I wanted to talk a little bit about a few of those drivers. First and foremost, there's the CSO policy, which we've talked a little bit about. The Clean Water Act requires it to be used in the development of permits, orders, or consent decrees for combined systems, and requires that those systems ultimately meet water quality standards. And so that's going to, in the communities where these are found, going to require significantly curbing stormwater loading to the combined system. So, and on top of that, the CSO policy requires, as a component of the long-term control plan, an evaluation of alternatives, which EPA has recognized should involve a look at green infrastructure and whether or not it's going to help achieve the same ends at a reasonable cost. Second, EPA has a once-in-a-generation opportunity to reform the baseline requirements applicable to urban and suburban stormwater sources. So right now there are some rules on the books that, in our view, are significantly outdated. EPA has announced it's planning to modernize those regulations to reflect water quality needs better. The Act gives EPA the authority to develop performance requirements, these retention standards, as I was describing, for categories of stormwater where it's causing water quality problems. So we are pushing hard for EPA to have retention-based standards, not only for new and redeveloped sites, but to deal with existing sites that are already causing water quality problems. We're expecting a proposed rule from EPA in the coming months, and we're particularly on the lookout for whether the rule will address existing sites and importantly for today's topic, whether it will apply in CSO areas, which is something that the agency hasn't committed to one way or the other. Third, to jumpstart the process of getting existing sites better controlled, NRDC and several of our partners have petitioned EPA under existing law, a requirement known as residual designation for Clean Water Act wonks. What it would do is require sites that discharge to already polluted waters to obtain pollution permits. And if granted, we think these petitions will help municipalities, including those with combined systems, reduce the stormwater loading to their infrastructure. And as permits would need to be stringent enough to meet a variety of water quality standards. And they would obviously, if they were retention-based, promote green infrastructure. I wanted to stress the point about helping municipalities. Both these petitions and EPA's rule have the potential to regulate and require stormwater retention of sites directly, parking lots, big developments, other things like that, that will require the owners or the developers of those sites to engineer them in a way that retains stormwater. What that does is takes from the municipality, which today is bearing the responsibility for these long-term control plans for stormwater permits where they have separate systems, to do all of the work to meet standards. It would offload some of that obligation onto the private sector, which is developing land and creating impervious area. So, of course, these things will only drive green infrastructure to the extent that it's economically smart alternative to conventional stormwater management. I'm confident that'll happen, but I think it's important in all of these analyses that communities scrutinize not only the installation costs of gray versus green, but also look at the benefits that green infrastructure provides above and beyond that of some of the gray systems, like air quality benefits and increased property values, things like that, which is one of the reasons that Philadelphia chose to go with an all-green system. And so I'll just leave this slide up for some ideas that I had about questions you might want to explore as you cover CSO issues in your community.
Is there a way that we can make this available?
Absolutely, absolutely. Happy to give it to you. The ideas, I think, are relatively self-explanatory. My larger point is I don't think that the public well knows where CSOs are, whether they live in a community that has CSOs, what the health issues are that arise from CSO discharges, and how they can be addressed using conventional systems or green infrastructure.
Well, this is great. I asked them to do this, and I'll make sure that anybody will be able to find me and I can get it to you guys. Thank you very much. I've got a ton of questions I want to ask, but we have one more presentation to go. And I mean, you have questions, and we're going to try to get to that. Pardon? Can we wait?
It'll take me a second to hook up my technology here.
Oh, well,
so you can
ask a question.
How many cities are under consent?
How many cities?
The question is
decrees.
The question is how many cities are under consent decrees?
Technically, they're all under some kind of requirement, but they're sort of hierarchies of consent decrees. The big ones are if you have a federal consent decree, and then a lot of communities are under state orders, or at a minimum, there are permit requirements that require implementation of the programs.
Right. And as at least as of a couple years back, EPA estimated that of about 200 large systems with CSOs, there are, like I say, 700 some around the country, 172 had some kind of enforcement action at least initiated. So whether that's an administrative order or a consent decree.
So one of the things that Gordon does is when the EPA discovers there's a problem and comes visits a city or something like that, I mean, he works with these cities, a whole number of cities, to try to help them navigate the EPA regulatory process. So what does the EPA say when they come calling? Are they not nice?
They're not,
I think you're going to have to hold this if you're going to.
Yeah, I mean, I'm more of a stand up and do it kind of a person. Is this good?
Yes.
I spent over 30 years of my career working for cities, so my background actually parallels the Clean Water Act. I started as city engineer in Hampton, Virginia, at the time the Clean Water Act came about, and one of the first things I did as a city engineer was deal with Hampton was a combined sewer city, one of the oldest cities in the country. They had separated their sewers, but somewhat unsuccessfully. So I had, and it's very flat in Hampton, the highest place is 3 feet above sea level. And so all the sewage, goes by gravity, but it can only go about 1,000 feet, and then you have to have a pump station. So there were a lot of pump stations. And developers, being the way they are, they only want to build for them. So we had what I call them daisy chains of pump stations. You know, the growth would go out to here, and there'd be a pump station, and then it'd grow some more, and there'd be a pump station pumping back to the pump station that wasn't designed for that flow. And then you might have four or five of these lined up without sufficient capacity for wet weather flows. So when it really rained, you know, once that first one filled up, you know, you start having, had a few of these in Tennessee, we was in Kentucky, you start having overflows. So one of the first things I did was a program to address, they were called sanitary sewer overflows, but by today's standards, it was just residual combined sewer overflow impacts. I was Commissioner of Public Works in Lexington, Kentucky, which had a separate sewer system. They're now under a consent decree to deal with sanitary sewer overflows, not combined. And then for 18 years, I ran the Louisville, Kentucky Metropolitan Sewer District, which has both combined and separate sewers. I was involved in the development of the combined sewer, and to the extent that there was an attempt to do a separate sewer overflow policy back in the day. More recently was a co-author of the Guide to Managing Peak Wet Weather Flows in Systems. So currently I'm a resource for CH2M Hill to cities that for the most part are either under a consent decree, and I've worked with them on implementing it, in some cases helping them negotiate a consent decree, and in Baton Rouge recently helping them renegotiate a consent decree. These things, you know, may go on for 15 or 20 or 25 years. Things change, standards change, so renegotiating consent decrees is a... some of these slides are from I do workshops. So this one's from Bangor, poor little Bangor. They're like many of the combined sewer cities. They got one of the first consent decrees. You remember John Murphy from Bangor? He was finished the program, thought they were done. Unfortunately, the technology changes, and the way that they measured the overflow and the performance on their consent decree, I had to give them the bad news that they weren't quite measuring it properly, so they hadn't achieved the level that they... So now we're negotiating a second consent decree for Bangor, Maine. So this was this is how I led off the workshop there. This is the kind of thing I do. I'm not going to go into this. I'm just showing you that there's a lot of complexity to these things, even for a small community. And EPA made it clear, not only are we going to have you do another round of combined sewer control, we're going to impose new requirements for separate sewers on your system to address separate sewer overflows. And furthermore, we're going to have some stormwater requirements. So EPA is now doing enforcement actions combining combined sewer overflows, separate sewer overflows, and in some cases where they can, stormwater. And that is one of those bridges to the green infrastructure. So this is the kind of thing I do go in, and it's almost like an audit process that I use to help them figure out where they are compared to what EPA expects and what others are doing, identify gaps, and help them come up with compliance strategies. Comparing them, this is the major outcome in Bangor was to help them come up with a corrective action plan to avoid more stringent EPA enforcement. Unfortunately, Region 1 is a mad dog of CSO enforcement, and they're not going to let Bangor get away without another consent decree. What's going on in the wet weather world? EPA is still pursuing aggressive enforcement across the country. So those places that may not have had consent decrees for getting them, more recently San Antonio, for example, got a consent decree. Miami-Dade County is getting their second consent decree. New Jersey's finally stepping up on combined sewers. Region 2 and for some reason, Region 2 has lagged behind other regions, so it hasn't been fairly implemented across the country. SSO enforcement, separate sewer enforcement is stepping up. New requirements, much more detailed consent decrees than what we used to have back in the day. Back in the day, when we started this, we both were around at the beginning. You know, a consent decree might be 15 pages long. Now, it's not unusual to have a 130-page consent decree with appendices that run for hundreds of pages. That makes it difficult for reporters. And I've got a few slides to illustrate this. Here, just some recent, I call these big ones, because if you get the attention of US EPA and the Department of Justice, they do not come after you unless they want to make an example of you. So these consent decrees, even for a small city, can be very serious. In some cases, about a third of these cities contested them in the courts, and they all lost. So there is a big incentive to negotiating and trying to come up with what's best for your community. That's a heavy point of emphasis that I make when I'm working with these cities. A lot of times the mayors feel like, well, those feds can't tell us what to do, and I say, yes, they can. And they're not beyond putting a mayor in jail if they can get away with it. Injunctive relief packages, millions to billions. Millions to billions. And that's another thing for reporters in covering this, understanding that in almost all the communities that I work with, the biggest infrastructure investment in those communities is to address these sewer issues. So how can we leverage those investments for the good of the community? And that's why green infrastructure is such a good tool to engage the public. If you don't see anything, it's hard to convince the public anything's going on if it's all underground. And as an engineer, I can tell you a lot of these expensive concrete and pipe solutions really don't do much good for water quality. They may move us towards compliance, but ultimately we need to have more holistic solutions looking at watersheds. What are the real problems in the watershed, and how can we spend the money that we have to get the best results? So green infrastructure laid over that helps a lot. But you can see, I mean, these are big programs, and there's a whole new set that I haven't updated this slide recently, but... So this is the one that gets the attention of the mayors when I do a workshop. And they go, oh, you know, I didn't know that. There's also the fact that these things take so long to do. You're talking about spending money over, in some cases, 2 to 3 decades. And the trends have been for these time periods to be longer because the magnitude of the investments are going up. So covering what's going on in a consent decree over time becomes an issue. Now, EPA has put in requirements in all the recent consent decrees that call for much more public disclosure and reporting of results. So it is easier now to go in and find out what's going on than it used to be. And I think, Jim, you would probably say that in Louisville as an example, that you can at least get information better than you used to.
Yeah, there's two things that are really easy, that really helped me out as a reporter in Louisville. One is that the EPA requires this, there's like a listserv they have. It's an email notification of any time there's any kind of a sewage spill, an SSO kind of one. And also dry weather. And so if they have a spill that's not supposed to happen, I get an email, and then I write a story about it if it's big enough. And that's one thing. And the other is that you can get data on all the, they have to report quarterly and annually on all the sewage, where it spills, how much, when, where, and all that stuff. And so huge data sets.
And just to share with you, what do I advise communities that are in consent decrees or negotiating consent decrees? I've got my list of 10. Decide what you want out of the consent decree. Don't just let EPA and the state people tell you what to do. You know your system better than they do in most cases, and try to look at it and figure out how to get what you want. Keep your combined and separate sewer issues separate to the extent that you're in a legal negotiation and the laws are different
the regulations are different between combined and separate sewers, and it shouldn't be that way, but it is. And you just have to accept that reality. Pay attention to deadlines and due dates. They have penalties. Keep track of your penalty liability. I've dealt with some cities that have accumulated millions of dollars of stipulated penalties. And the joke used to be, well, EPA never collects them. Well, that's not true anymore. And the courts have supported EPA and the Department of Justice in collecting stipulated penalties at a very high level. The communities have tried to say, well, we had storms, or we had, you know, something broke down, there was a power failure, but there's a very high level of accountability that's associated with stipulated penalties. So communities have rung up the potential for millions of dollars of penalties to be assessed and paid. Make sure CMOM is a program. We don't have time to go into CMOM, but it has to deal with how you operate and maintain your system. It looks at every aspect. Many of the consent decrees are requiring communities now to have extensive CMOM requirements that get into every aspect of your business, including telling you that you have to inspect and clean 10% of your sewers every year. You know, well, they may not. A lot of the communities that I've started with, you know, well, what do you mean? You know, if it stops up, we go out and fix it. That's their cleaning program. So going from that to proactively inspecting and cleaning 10% of your system every year is a huge gap there for most communities, and it requires staff and resources and actually management tools that many of them don't have. Communicate with public, EPA. Don't assume that especially EPA reads anything you send. I know Paul always read all of the reports that came in from the communities, because he's one of the most well-informed and knowledgeable regulators who worked with the communities in Tennessee for many years. But sometimes I wonder if all these reports that are sent in get read. Hold engineers and contractors accountable for meeting the budgets and schedules. A lot of communities are lax in this regard. And only submit plans that you can meet. This is my sort of number one rule. Don't agree to anything that you can't do. Some communities do that. So I've got one more example since we're in Chattanooga. I'll show this one first. Just to give you some of the realities of what I do. These are just communities where the consulting firm that I work for is engaged, both 60 across the country. So I'm just a resource. So I do have a perspective from many communities about, and I know a lot about some of these and a little bit about most of them, much more than a person should know, actually. It's kind of scary at times how I'm spending my life. And let's see, I'm looking for the... Here we go, Chattanooga, since we're in Tennessee. This is what I do. One of the first things I do when I'm working with community, doing a workshop that's negotiating or has a consent decree, sometimes they'll give me their draft consent decrees, is just go into it and break it down. So here's Chattanooga's. And again, this is why it's hard for reporters to address the issues and explain these things to the public. They are so complicated. All of these, here are deliverables under the consent decree for the CMOM program, a SORP, an ERP, a FOG. I'm not, you know, again, I could do all-day workshop explain these things. In 7 months, you deliver your SORP. In 13 months, your FOG program. In 19 months, your pump station operation. When I say they're getting into every aspect of the business, you know, this is what's happening in consent decrees, and why the people you may be dealing with in the communities have a little trouble at times explaining what they're doing and why for you to translate to the public. A banking credit system for capacity, that was an interesting aspect of Chattanooga. Because of some capacity problems that they had historically in the system.
long capital early action capital improvement projects. Many communities, almost all every consent decree, will have millions and millions of dollars of projects they're supposed to go out and do in 3 to 5 years or less. Heavy monitoring requirements. So anyway, I just wanted to show you this is the local consent decree broken down into bullet points.
If I were the Chattanooga reporter, I would probably want that list right there and just
can't have it.
Use it as a checklist for stories I need to do. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. We have we can go a little longer than 10:15 because there's a big long break afterwards. So we have some time for some questions here. I've got some, but let's first open it up to anybody in the audience. SEJ members and work in press come first, and that's about all I see here, so that's good. Yes, you had your hand up first.
So a consent decree is a much different animal from a permit that's issued to a wastewater treatment plant. It doesn't have specific standards, per se.
Well, this is an area where EPA and the states have been very inconsistent, and through the years, there was a long going argument. The municipalities say, "Well, put it in our permits. Permits are for 5 years. Some of these programs go 10, 15, or 20." So EPA and the states said, "No, we can't, because we've got to give you an enforcement order because it's more than 5 years." And that's been very inconsistently administered. But in general, nowadays, everybody's going to have an enforceable order, either a state order or a consent decree. I mean, that's just, if they don't have one, it's just because EPA and the states haven't got around to them yet.
And then the details of what happens implementing those things over the 5-year period governed by the permit will be spelled out in the permit.
Yeah, under the permit system, and why municipalities liked it, is, okay, you have permit requirements. If you meet the permit requirements, you're in compliance. And if you didn't meet them, then you would be subject to enforcement. So you wouldn't get the order unless you failed to achieve what was in the permit. And that's why I liked it, because if you had a compliance mentality, you would stay out front. But now it's just, you're going to get your consent decree, you're going to have to do all these things. It's all subject to penalties and schedules that are very, very detailed and prescriptive.
Yeah, the other thing that we didn't talk about, the consent decree, there's provision in Clean Water Act that citizens can sue persons for violation of the Clean Water Act. And if there's a consent decree in place that and covering essentially the same violation, that blocks the citizen suit. But the bottom line is, and what I always told my cities was, there are two worlds. You're substantially in compliance, not perfect, but substantially in compliance, or you're in enforcement. Those are the only two worlds. And municipal wastewater systems, almost none of them are substantially in compliance. So almost every municipal wastewater system is in an enforcement posture. And so the smart thing for them to do is not say, I tell you what, I'm going to avoid enforcement. The smart thing for them to do is, just as Gordon said, manage that enforcement. And from your standpoint, from the standpoint of informing the public, you'd like to have some involvement. And the truth is, you can. EPA is receptive to it.
This is some of the hypocrisy from, it's not intended to be this, but I consider it that. EPA faces will tell you, we want public input. You guys advocated as a board chair of the Kentucky Waterways Alliance. We want public input. We want to have an opportunity to be involved. What's the first thing that happens when EPA takes enforcement action to bring about a consent decree? Department of Justice.
Confidentiality.
Everything is confidential. No, there's no public involvement, no opportunity for the only way the public can get involved is if NRDC or some other group intervenes and gets standing from the court to be at the table. Otherwise,
which costs you 46 cents on a sheet of paper, on an envelope.
I have to periodically file Freedom of Information Act requests and state open records requests just to see how things are going with the, as I'm trying to monitor my agency, and because they're not going to put a press release out typically if there's a problem, and the EPA will produce any number of if you ask for the correspondence between the enforcement people and the agency, it's amazing what you'll get. Just on May 29th this year, Louisville Metropolitan Sewer District has been slapped with a $161,000 fine for allowing nearly 400 illegal sewage discharges in 2011 and 2012 that spilled more than 100 million gallons. There was no press release issued. The local agency, which is trying to be more transparent, they do this stuff in closed session. You have to be there at the end of closed session to figure out whether or not something happened. It's not always easy to be there at the end of closed session unless you're going to sit, you know, on the carpet outside the room or whatever. So I'm just saying that you just have to use all your reporter tools to, you know, to get access to these things. And then you can, you know, does get kind of secret.
Well, I'll argue with that just a little bit. I mean, the purpose of the confidentiality agreement is to allow settlement discussions to take place. And what I would say is if citizens would just come to the door and say, you know what, there may be some settlement negotiations that happen in that room, but here are some objectives that my group thinks are important, or on behalf of this or that citizen interest group, or I've lived in this town a long time myself and I think it's important, and here's some things I want to see done. And if the press asks to be involved in an issue and says, tell you what, I want to know how it is that you are, Gordon explained these consent orders will tell city, you have to do this and you have to do that. I want to know how you decided in what order to do those things. I want to know which community suffers longer and which communities sewer issues are resolved sooner. And I want to know how you decided that. And you know, that's the concept of environmental justice. And how did you, are you taking care of the right people first? Are you reducing the highest risk to public health first? Are you arranging what you're doing? And this, you'll see this tension in cities say, well, tell you what, if we did this first, that would facilitate some initial development in this direction, and we'd like to do that. And from the public standpoint, we say, wait a minute, what we want you to do is we want you to resolve public health issues first.
Yeah.
And that takes some smarts to figure that out.
But I do want to stress what Jim said. There's a real public service that journalists can provide in the ongoing monitoring of how these plans are getting implemented and the success that they're having. Nobody who's running a sewer system wants to talk about their overflow when it happens, you know, or the fact that there's been a beach closure as a result of it, or that, you know, people were just playing in extreme. Those, even though that can help them justify the increased fees that are going to need to be raised to pay for sewer upgrades, that's still it's not great from a public, you know, from a public relations standpoint. And so the more that the public understands and sees the impacts of overflows and the efforts going on to address them, I think that both sides win in that. The public knows what's going on, but the sewer system is able to more easily explain on an ongoing basis why they need to do X, Y, and Z, why they're ripping up this part of town, and why sewer fees are going up.
Just one more point with regard to the seat at the table, in your green infrastructure point. In some cases, the only reason that green infrastructure has been emphasized in some of these communities that are now doing it is because of public
public
engagement in the process.
Yep.
A lot of, not a lot, but some of the wastewater utilities are very traditionally focused. It goes back to the German sanitary engineering tradition, and they do not believe in green infrastructure, and so it's a battle between, even within the agencies, between the staff may not agree. You may have half the staff that are embracing green infrastructure, and the other half, well, that's a bunch of crap. You know, we're not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a role more than ever now for public engagement in this. You know, how this money is being spent, and emphasizing, you know, watershed improvements, and let's spend the money where we're going to get the most benefit in this watershed.
Absolutely.
I'd like to ask one quick question here before we go back to you guys, because it's a point that I think we need to get into discussion, and it does have to do with money, and how are, and we don't have to dwell on this very long because we do have more questions, but how are cities paying for this? They're borrowing it. What kind of a burden is that putting on communities? And is there any, I mean, does the EPA factor how much this is going to cost in any of their evaluations about what to do? So that's the first part. And then I also do want to just talk briefly about what reporters can do to sort of watchdog their agencies to make sure they're spending money correctly.
The every consent decree has something more or less to the effect of not having enough money is no excuse. So the cities are signing, you know, when you sign the consent decree, you're saying it doesn't matter what it costs. Smart cities are negotiating upset limits or some kind of provisions to address how much is being spent. But the only way it's being paid for, as a practical matter, there are a few little grant pots here and there, is raising the rates. And in most cases in these cities, we're talking about, you know, the rule of thumb would be the rates are going to double. But if you start a consent decree program for CSOs or SSOs, before you're done with it, your rates are going to double. And if you're managing it good. If not, it could be worse than that.
There are only two types of money in the world. There's ratepayer money and taxpayer money. And the municipalities are, you heard the municipalities say unfunded mandates, and meaning the meaning of that is that we need to pay for this with taxpayer money instead of ratepayer money. And federal government needs to step in and help us, and to some extent, happens, but it's expensive. The projects are as Gordon said, they're tremendously expensive. They're long term. They require public support, public to understand where that money is going. There's tremendous competition, you know, in cities for money. There's a concept now of affordability, and the basis of that is cities come and say, look, 2% of median household income. If our people have to pay more than 2% of median household income, that is an unaffordable fix, and we shouldn't be required to do it. And the bad, from my standpoint, the bad part of that is it rewards cities who have pushed and pushed and pushed off the maintenance, CMOM, the maintenance that Gordon talked about. If they've pushed it and they've built up a tremendous, like Marley's ghost, they've got a long chain of sins that now they have to take care of. Well, they say now, but that 2% affordability, that's the limit of what we have to pay, and that's not okay. I mean, that's if a town has kept up and done the best they could and made regular maintenance and so forth, you know, I have some sympathy to that argument. But they're going to have to. That's the baseline for them to show me that they.
Yeah, there's. I mean, there's not a whole lot of money from the feds. You know, the gap between need and federal support is huge. And the way that EPA tends to deal with affordability issues is just the length of time to meet the standards. But I think the cost issue also just underscores the importance of communication about why they're doing this in the first place. You know, the economic research, public opinion research, all routinely shows that people are willing to pay for clean water and for the access to urban streams that are swimmable is a huge community benefit that people will. I think it's important for municipal leaders, for environmental officials who are insisting on cleanup, to communicate why they're doing this in the first instance and what the world is going to look like after they're done. And that's one thing I think Philadelphia has done really well. It's talked about not only how waterways are going to be improved, but this is what your city is going to look like. These are the green infrastructure installations, and this is what how the world is going to be better because we're making these investments that you're going to largely be paying for.
You've been patient. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Susan Moran, a freelance journalist in Boulder, Colorado. So I'm wondering about all these states west of 100th Meridian, particularly in Colorado, related to stormwater, rainwater retention, where the water laws are so different. Not to get too granular about it for just Colorado, but I don't know how does this apply to those kind of interior west?
Well, in arid and semi-arid areas, the sewer overflows don't manifest as frequently. The emphasis in the programs is more on the wastewater treatment. And in most of those states, the wastewater is becoming so valuable that it needs to be reclaimed for other uses. So that value of the water, it gets into the value of water thing. When the water gets so valuable that the wastewater needs to be reclaimed, then that drives the program. Then it doesn't need to be enforcement because there's interest in capturing that water and reusing it.
Right. I guess I'm thinking not just water scarcity, but for the senior, junior water
yeah.
they
can't mm. Yeah, yeah. So in for the vast majority of the West, with the exception of the few systems that you saw in the Pacific Northwest and there are a couple in California, there aren't combined sewers in the West. So what you're that's right, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
The San Antonio just got $1 billion consent decree though for separate sewer overflows, but they've got the Edwards Aquifer, it's their water supply, you know, so there's a heavy emphasis on both stormwater and impacts of sewer overflows.
But those communities do have separate storm sewer systems, and those have to be permitted under the Clean Water Act, and those have to and those permits are supposed to ensure that they're not causing water quality problems, which they're doing all over the place. So they're also going to have to deal with the increased volume that urbanization brings and start to retain water on site. And your question about kind of legal rights, my rough understanding is that that's something that people have expressed some concerns about. It hasn't really manifested itself as a real, like having retention obligations hasn't been found to violate, somebody else's claim to the water downstream.
So one quick comment about money. They also borrow a lot of money, and every time they issue bonds, one potential area for stories for you to look at is how they're paying their lawyers to issue and financial advisors to issue those bonds. Many years after Gordon left, I found in Louisville that there were two different law firms, and I mean it was as if they were double charging, and nobody was looking. It was the lawyers were making a lot of money for not doing what seemed to me a lot of work. But anyway, Tom's been waiting.
I wanted.
And this is Tom Henry, Toledo Blade.
Toledo Blade. I've been covering this issue for years, maybe close to 20 years. I wanted to add a couple of statements to help with a couple of these questions and then ask a question myself. One thing was on the funding. Reporters should know that there's a very bureaucratic but very important part of the US EPA's budget. It's called the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. I wish the EPA guy was here, but it's the largest part of the EPA's budget, billions of dollars. Every municipality does get federal money. I can't remember offhand. I want to say 40 to 50% of a, like in Toledo, which has been under consent decree for a while. And it's divided up. It's billions of dollars. 50 states by law, each state has to get, you know, according to their population, a fair distribution. But it, the key part of it is highly politicized because when the EPA is under pressure to cut their budget and Congress is under pressure to present a more balanced budget, you'll see, and I've studied this for years, the National Wildlife Federation in the Great Lakes region has studied this for years too. It'll fluctuate, it'll bounce up and down between different administrations. It got whacked pretty good during the Bush administration. Obama started putting more money into it, and then when the, in 2010, when the Tea Party, Republicans took the 2010 election, then he started whacking at it too. So it's always been kind of subject to political whims because, you know, as I've told people, sewage is not a sexy issue, and it eludes a lot of people, and it's an easy, soft target for a lot of cuts in Congress, but it's one to keep an eye on. Also be aware that the reporting spills, the data that's generated varies greatly from state to state how they do it. In Ohio, we have a horrible reporting compared to our sister state, Michigan. Michigan, you can go on right now, and it's one of the best I've seen. You can go online anywhere in the state of Michigan. Historically, as far back as records have gone, which is probably the early to mid-90s, and you can find anywhere, any date, the number of gallons, you know, the place it's overflowing and everywhere like that. In Ohio, they have maintained for years that they don't have confidence in the volume, the gauges that measure volume. So they go strictly by a hourly duration. And I've had different overflows that I've looked at, historic, you know, I know where out of like 30, 35 or 40 combined sewer overflows in the city of Toledo, which ones are the most likely to have the longest spills. And sometimes, I mean, you're talking about raw sewage after a heavy storm that's continuous for 3 to 4 days of just raw, and you try to get somebody to put that into gallons, they won't do it, but still just, I guess it's left to the imagination of what kind of an impact you're having after several days.
And your question?
I'm getting there. I was trying to, you know, offer a couple of things.
For, yeah, sure.
Here. Also be combined, the consent decrees can be dragged out. In Toledo, we've had, they've made the case for extenuating circumstances because of the economy. They've gone several times. We were supposed to have ours completed by 2015. It's now out to 2025 or so for shutting down the CSOs and doing everything. One reason why we moved up on the CSO list is our former mayor held press conferences and said at various press conferences said that. I don't mind keeping this held up in court because it's cheaper to keep it in court than it is to comply.
He was a legendary resistor.
Cardi Kingbinder you're talking about. Yeah. And from what
does that strategy work, by the way?
It didn't.
From what I heard, pay
me now, pay me later.
Yeah, from what I heard, that kind of took us from this area and bumped us way up in that just because his brazen attitude towards But anyways, that big wind-up, Jim, my question was, the Great Lakes region, you know, a lot of the CSOs, unlike Louisville, you're gonna have a CSO. It's gonna go downstream, and you're kind of like the joke of Chicago's crap goes down to St. Louis and so forth. But in the Great Lakes region, a lot of communities like Toledo, they're putting it back into the Great Lakes area, and Toledo's putting their sewage in, and it's contributing to Western Lake Erie's algae and the water intakes out there, and we're drinking water that's been purified after the sewage and everything. Is there, do you feel that is there a need for a higher, either a higher threshold or more sense of urgency in an area like the Great Lakes, which has been kind of a standard setter for a lot of water quality regulations, and also just to illustrate the cost of these, of $23 billion that it's been estimated to restore the Great Lakes to the optimum levels, over half of that is attributed to sewage. I just wanted your thoughts on
there is
priorities of the Great Lakes versus other areas.
Well, I think the Great Lakes have their priorities. I mean, they're out in front on standards development, and the Great Lakes states in general are pushing other parts of the country from the work that's going there. So you could argue that they haven't gone far enough, fast enough, but I think they're doing a lot. The biggest problem with the sewer overflow issue, I think, historically has been who's going to make the water quality evaluations and how are they going to be done. So the monitoring, there's a big difference between monitoring how much sewage overflows to monitoring the water quality impacts of those overflows. So the municipalities say, well, that's the state's job, or that's EPA's job, or somebody else's job. So you have this gap between the events and what may be happening on the water quality, and that I think that holds back making the right decisions about how long should it take and what are these real impacts.
Do you see this as, from an ecology standpoint, Toledo would like to have us believe that they're having a negligible effect on algae and Western Lake Erie's toxic algae, I've written a lot about, has the same toxins that killed people in Brazil years ago. And it's becoming a bigger and bigger international issue. U.S. and Canada have many teams on this. But it's mostly blamed on farm runoff and phosphorus.
Sure, it's those other guys.
In the field, but there's phosphorus in sewage. And the sewage plant, there's always kind of a tension there between the farmers and the sewage plant. Whose phosphorus is really causing these massive algae?
And the answer is both.
Yeah.
Well,
the answer is both, but nationwide, agriculture contributes dramatically more nutrients to U.S. waters than municipal systems do. No question about that.
We've got some time for a few more questions. And, Alyssa, you said you had one more.
Yeah, so I'm Alyssa Yancey. I'm from Cincinnati. I teach at the university there and report for WCPO on environmental topics. And so I just actually did a story about our CSO. CSO 5, I've heard is notorious around the country.
Yeah.
My question is about green versus gray infrastructure and the EPA's willingness to look at the green infrastructure solutions versus the gray infrastructure solutions. We had to work, I think, 3 or 4 years to get the Lake Run project approved, which is much more green infrastructure.
Yep.
We had to prove over and over again that it was economically sound. So how does the EPA look at these alternatives, and how can communities and how can reporters sort of get a sense of opportunity costs versus, we can make another big pipe, but sort of the short versus long-term gain? And is it harder with the EPA, or how does that factor into the
So the question has to do with evaluating green versus gray infrastructure and what EPA criteria may be involved.
Yeah. And I mean, even we could 5 years ago, you had part of EPA embracing green infrastructure and good to go, and then the enforcement people
saying
that has changed dramatically in a short period of time. And it's to NRDC's credit that they have influenced that
because they're like the environmental police for EPA. You know, keep their eyeballs on what's going on. You know, we got lawyers too, and they get great technical staff at NRDC. So it's the acceptance of green is much better, but also the capability of the municipalities and their engineers to prove. And I fully support this. I mean, EPA says and the states say, you know, prove to us this stuff's going to work. So we've gotten a lot better at doing that. Louisville's doing a great job. Cincinnati, Philadelphia's obviously helped all of us with the work that they've done. So
yeah, I absolutely agree with that. In the beginning, EPA said go out and use green infrastructure, and by the way, get these results. Well, the engineering community had confidence and experience with the built infrastructure, and when they're going to put their name on it and say, we will deliver these results, or, you know, it's a our performance contract, they didn't exactly know what they were going to be getting out of the green infrastructure.
Yeah.
And I'll say something else about green infrastructure, though. I mean, Philadelphia is such a good example, but there are green infrastructure practices at Philadelphia, and you can load up a bunch of folks from Nashville and take them to Philadelphia and say, look what they're doing. Let's do the same thing in Nashville. Well, the geology has to be, you've got to think about geology. And so in Philadelphia, you take the pitcher of water, pour it on the ground, it sinks in. In Nashville, there's rock right there. I mean, green infrastructure is a different concept in different geology. And so you can't just go to a conference over here and say, we're going to do the same thing in my town. It has to be site-specific, and so you need a local expert to talk about green infrastructure.
And another thing that I think they've done well at EPA, again, I completely agree that they've really changed and really embraced it on the enforcement side now, too, is you'll see a lot of decrees, I don't recall whether Cincinnati is among them, where there's a built-in ability to shift some of the investment that is anticipated to be gray to green based on demonstration projects that are built into the decree, and as they get proven up, the decree has flexibility within it to propose back to EPA, well, we're instead of dealing with this many gallons with a tunnel, we're going to downsize the tunnel, we're going to build X, Y, and Z. And
we did exactly that in Nashville. Decree.
If we keep answers really short, we can do one more question from the audience, and then I have one final question. So go ahead.
I'm from New York City, Allison Jones, with a project called No Water, No Life. And last fall, I was at a seminar called Bridge Fest. That is mostly folks from Columbia University. And they were saying that in New York, the infrastructure, green infrastructure, gray infrastructure, is all going to take so long, and it's so daunting, and it's, they were so frustrated. They said, really what we need to do is mount a campaign for residents changing behavior during wet events, no showers, no laundry, no washing.
Mm-hmm.
Because they said, not only will it take some input into the sewers, but it will also be awareness raising. Have you all ever heard that term?
The National Association of Clean Water Agencies just engaged in a war to take on those same issues and to ramp way up the public education about how your individual behaviors can help. I'm probably an old fogey on that. I mean, I certainly believed and committed as a utility manager more resources than most utilities in public education and outreach. But compared to what's needed, it's just, you know, it's a huge obstacle to overcome. Somehow the behavioral issues has to be incentivized in some kind of way. I don't know.
But I think we've done exactly that in some enforcement actions that I've been involved in regarding if we had a industrial pretreater that's coming into a municipality, that's an interruptible flow. And we said, part of what we want you to do, until you get that, until we have high confidence that that water is being reliably treated, I mean, transported to treatment, we want you to put those people on interruption. And if you are, if you're experiencing an overflow, you have to put them on storage or take them off.
I think it's important that folks understand the impact of their own activities. And although not directly to your point, I have seen in a lot of communities stormwater fees be structured so in a way that individual property owners can reduce their fee if they've installed retention capacity on them. So that's a way of making them making folks understand how they're influencing a bigger pollution problem.
And a lot of it was about getting people to be willing to support the funding that would be needed.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Okay, so took advantage of our full 15 minutes of extra time. I do want to try something here. Maybe it's a little silly. I just want you to nod yes or no on this. No matter all these consent decrees that are being done all over the country, they're not going to make our waterways meet water quality standards without also having stormwater control programs that are effective too, right? Okay, good. So that's just one piece of the puzzle. Okay, so Exhibit Hall D, there's coffee, tea, water, soda. The concurrent sessions 4 begin at 10:45. Thank you very, very much for sticking around for this whole thing. We appreciate the questions. And please give a little round of applause to these speakers who came here on their own dime and their own time.